and welcome to A Bookish Home. This is your host, Laura Zara-Kopinski, librarian, writer, and all-around bookworm. And joining me today is Maggie Doherty, author of the new book, The Equivalents.
Maggie Doherty is a literary scholar, historian, and critic based at Harvard, where she earned her PhD in English and where she currently teaches writing, literature, and history. Her writing has appeared in many publications, including The New Republic and The New York Times. She lives in Somerville, Massachusetts. Her new book is called The Equivalents, a story of art, female friendship, and liberation in the 1960s. Maggie Doherty, welcome to A Bookish Home. I've really been looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me, Laura. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Yes, I began reading this book before many of our lives were sort of turned upside down with the COVID-19 crisis. We're recording this toward the end of April. And it's been interesting as I finished the book and prepared for the interview, I kept thinking how this whole idea of looking back at how women were trying to experiment with ways to balance creativity and motherhood and domestic responsibilities is more relevant than ever. So it's sort of, I'm sure it's a very interesting time to be having a book coming out, but I'm wondering if if the topic also feels just more interesting to people than ever.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think that's such an interesting point. And to be honest, I hadn't conceived of that myself, that in a way we've sort of gone back to the housebound 50s for a moment, that, you know, in that time, the home was such an important place and symbol. And you weren't really, especially if you were a woman at the time, weren't really encouraged to leave it. You know, I have a friend who had a baby in January. And she said to me yesterday that the hardest thing for her about this kind of self-isolation period is that she's always relied on having a separate workspace. She teaches college writing as well. And she said the hardest thing is that she can't go away to do her work. So even though, you know, her partner's there and he's able to take the baby when she has a meeting or has to do any kind of work at home, that mentally it's just really hard for her to be in the same space with her child and with her partner and also be inhabiting her kind of professional intellectual self. And that is in real time
because as we're talking, I'm hearing downstairs, I have a 3-year-old and a baby and I hear crying of some sort with my husband downstairs. I'm like, yeah,
right.
That sounds about right. You're still all together.
It's mental. I mean, my partner's son is with us right now and they're off in at the other end of the apartment doing something. I don't know what it is. But it is, I mean, I think it's as much a mental relationship to space and to your own role in a space as anything, that if you're in a home, it's hard to think of yourself as also some other you, some other version of you that you don't necessarily associate with your kind of domestic self.
That's fascinating. Well, let's back up a bit. So we both live in Massachusetts, and I actually even worked at Harvard for a time, and I knew nothing of this chapter in history, and I found it just so interesting. Tell us a little bit about how you discovered the Institute and sort of got interested in this period of time and these women.
Yeah, I had the same experience. So I was a graduate student at Harvard in English. And I, you know, I grew up in the area, so I was familiar with the university. And I think I even knew a little bit about the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, which is the name that the institute goes by today. And I sort of knew that it was a place for highly accomplished scholars and writers and artists to stay for a year and, you know, do their work and have a kind of reprieve from whatever the rest of their working lives are. So I was writing a dissertation on, and one of the writers that I was studying was the writer Tilly Olson. And I learned from her biographer that she had spent some time at the Radcliffe Institute. And I said, oh, that's interesting. So I went over to the Schlesinger Library, which is this amazing, amazing resource for anyone interested in women's history. They have the archives of so many writers and thinkers and organizations. And so I looked in the Institute archives just to see what Olson had been up to and why she was here. And that's when I discovered the whole backstory to the Institute as a place that was designed specifically to even out some of the inequalities facing women, especially women with children in the 1950s and 1960s, that the founder of the Institute, the president of Radcliffe College, saw an opportunity to give a little bit of assistance to women that she recognized or expected had all of these intellectual ambitions and artistic and scholarly projects that they just couldn't pursue given their domestic responsibilities. So that... that backstory, I share your sort of surprise at it. I just had no idea. I thought, you know, the Radcliffe Institute was just yet another kind of way to recognize highly accomplished people of any kind of persuasion or background. And I was really just intrigued, and I started looking through the files, the archival materials associated with the Institute, and learned that all of these women that I knew from history and from literary history had been there at some point in time. Alice Walker had been there. Kay Ryan had been there. Denise Levertov, Anne Sexton. And I, you know, I, at the time, I didn't really know what to do with this information. So I just kind of filed it away and thought, huh, that's a really interesting story. Maybe I'll have a way to tell it someday. And then eventually that someday came around for me.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And the whole, structure of the experiment I thought was fascinating too, and the connection to I've always loved Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, and I've been noticing more and more how many connections that book has to different authors and writers. I spoke to Kate Bollock recently, and she was talking about some research she did on whether that book had influenced Louisa May Alcott at all, and just how so many of us who are in this space of thinking about women's contributions to the arts and literature, so much of it comes back to that A Room of One's Own book. And it reminded me, well, I'll back up. So when we're talking about the experiment, the idea that one of the elements was they were going to get this room of their own, this office. Can you tell us a little bit about the components of the experiment and why they thought that each of them was so important? Like, I know the stipend, for instance, was a really important part of it.
Well, I think that Woolf actually gets at this in her essay, right? So when she's talking about the importance of having a room of your own, she also talks about the importance of money. She says, you know, if you want to have this really interesting creative life, you need a room of one's own, and you need the money to kind of support that solitude and that creativity. And so I think that when Bunting, who was a scientist, so she always considered herself, even after she moved into college administration and university administration, she always thought like a microbiologist. And so she thought in terms of hypotheses and results and repeating experiments. And so the way she thought of the Institute was as an experiment, or sometimes she called it a laboratory, and she wanted it to be replicable. So she didn't have any illusions that Radcliffe as a single institution would be able to change the fate of women across the country. But she hoped that if they ran this experiment and they gave women office space, access to university resources, and a stipend that at the time would have been between $2,000 and $3,000, which is about $28,000 today, she hypothesized that if they had these forms of assistance, they would be able to produce really great work. And she hoped that other institutions would replicate the experiment. They would look over and see what was happening and see how this work was inspiring undergraduates and how it was generating attention for the institution, and they would be moved to do a similar thing. This didn't really happen across different institutions, in part because right around the same time, the women's movement kind of kicked off. So there were a lot more changes happening in a lot of different directions. But to go back to why I think all of these different elements were significant, the office space was obviously, as you were alluding to with Wolf, and as we were talking about at the beginning, having a separate space away from the home was sort of functionally and pragmatically important, just to not have kids sort of knocking at your study door, trying to get in and get a snack or talk to you. Anne Sexton said she could always, even when she was locked in her study, her daughters at the time just constantly wanted to get in and talk to her. But I think it was also a kind of symbolic thing. There was a former fellow, a former institute fellow who was part of this inaugural class that I spoke to when I began my book research. And she said that she and her children loved seeing her off in the morning, that they were going to school and they would say to her, okay, we're going to our small school. You're going to go to the big school. And there was something about that leave taking from the home that felt important. Having the offices together was also really important. So even though every fellow had their own space to work and to be alone and to have the kind of solitude that Wolf prizes, they also were able to talk together. They could go visit each other. They had seminar discussions all together at the bottom, in the bottom of the house where their offices were. So there was this interplay between solitude and community that was designed to facilitate some collaboration and mutual inspiration. The money, I think, in addition to being really practical, you know, there's an artist in the book, Barbara Swan, who bought a dishwasher with it. And she said that this saved her, you know, tons of hours of domestic labor and allowed her to paint a little bit more. There was also a kind of symbolic value to that. Anne Sexton once said to an interviewer that she felt like it made her poetry look professional to her in-laws. So rather than looking like a hobby or like something she was doing kind of just to pass the time, the fact that there was money associated with it made her able to say, no, this is not just a hobby. This is what I do for a living. This is, you know, something that the world recognizes as valuable. So I think all of these elements that we're talking about had this very pragmatic way of assisting the members of the Institute, but also had this broader resonance that kind of communicated something about their intellectual seriousness and their creative seriousness to a world and to, you know, an audience that wasn't kind of primed to see those things on their own, that sometimes saw a woman painting or writing poetry and saw that as unserious or insignificant or a distraction or an indulgence. And all of these Institute elements kind of changed the way those things were viewed or try to communicate a certain kind of professionalism and integrity to these activities.
I think that's so interesting. And I was struck too, you were saying that one of them bought a dishwasher, and just seeing how quite a few did put the money toward either getting help with housework or childcare. And it was just funny to me to be thinking, you know, I listen to a lot of different, you know, podcasts or read different books about, you know, how to make it all work. And I feel like one of the advice that you hear so often is outsourcing. And I just thought it was interesting that, like, you know, even then, I kind of would have thought that the money would have gone toward, you know, just kind of got sucked into the just household expenses of, you know, paying a bill or whatever, but that they strategically outsourced labor so that they could have more time for their professional and artistic pursuits. I was like, oh, that advice really hasn't changed so much in for many years.
Right. And there's, you know, there's a certain, I think one thing to remember about the first women who attended the Institute is that with only a few exceptions, they were middle class to upper middle class women. Initially, all of them were white. So they were already in a pretty good place financially. And this is during the kind of brief moment in American history where the single breadwinner model was kind of working for a lot of people. You had, you know, one person in the couple working full time, and that really was supposed to support the whole household. So for many of them, this income was really supplemental. And this kind of went hand in hand with expectations around mothering at the time. This was also right after Dr. Spock publishes his book on babies. And there was this kind of investment in mothering as a really important activity, which was both kind of nice, right? To see this as like something that, you know, was important and people should take seriously, but also put a lot of pressure on women to really devote themselves to being with their children in a way that sort of forbid them from doing anything else, even if that anything else would have been sort of helpful to the running of the household. Mm-hmm. I think there's also something what you said about outsourcing, I do think is important to, you know, maybe note the irony, or at least the initial way that this institute ran was to encourage outsourcing, but not necessarily to see that there was any kind of conflict between rewarding some women who seem to have talent or capacity and asking other women to kind of pick up the slack for those women. Mm-hmm. You know, many of these women hired childcare, housekeepers. And at first there wasn't really a contradiction visible in that this was a way of elevating a class of women that already had a bunch of advantages socially, and then sort of de-emphasizing or devaluing the contributions of the women who were making that work for them, who were providing their childcare. This has changed a lot since the Institute was founded in 1960. I think outside, or I think even now, there is still this conflict between how do you make your life work? Who do you rely on for help? And is that outsourcing or finding help in any way kind of contradicting your values or the kind of world you're trying to make, and the kind of equality you're hoping to invest in or bring about? So I think the challenge of that is still really, really present.
I think so too. And I think in a way, you know, the current crisis that we're living in also pokes a lot of holes in that recommendation, because, mm-hmm. you know, there is really no outsourcing right now. Right, you're not there, you know, daycares aren't open, and you're right. not necessarily gonna, you know, be able to have someone come take care of your kids or clean your house or any of that. So that advice sort of also disappears. You know, as you're talking about the class of women that the Institute was really aiming to help at first, I thought the whole selection process was interesting. If you could talk about that a little bit, and I guess just sort of the public reaction to the Institute as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't think anyone anticipated how popular this idea would be. So the Institute for Independent Study, which is the original title of the Institute, gets announced November 20th, 1960. And there's a front page article in the New York Times. And within a day, they've received hundreds of letters of inquiry. The phone is ringing nonstop. And you have women from all parts of the country, from all different backgrounds, calling or writing in to say, this is incredibly appealing. How can I apply? So there was so much interest. You know, this was a program that was designed to host 20 women, and you suddenly have, you know, hundreds of women saying they want to apply. So they had to put some parameters on who they would accept. So because it was a commuting situation, they really limited the applicants to women in the Boston area who could commute. This changed in the second year, where the writer Tilly Olson, who lived in San Francisco, came from San Francisco and moved to Boston with her husband and her youngest daughter. But at first, it was really just women in the Boston area. And they asked that these women have a PhD, or what they called the equivalent of accomplishment or training in the arts. And that's where the book gets its name. And that's where the friend group that's at the center of the book gets its name, because these were five artists who sort of jokingly called their friend group the equivalents, because none of them had PhDs, but they all were highly, highly accomplished artists. But so those two parameters really did narrow the field a little bit. Bunting was really interested in women with graduate degrees who she felt had put off their research and scholarly pursuits because they'd gotten married and had children. And this sort of reflected her own path. She had managed to continue her scholarship while having children, and she wanted women to do the same. So even with those parameters in place, they still had 200 formal applications. Wow. So there was still a lot of interest. The selection process was really just Bunting and then the woman she'd hired to direct the institute, Constance Smith, who was a political scientist who had also been a college administrator. They were just kind of going through the applications and then interviewing the women in person. I think they interviewed 150 of them. But one element of the selection process that I find quite interesting is after, you know, the women running this institute made their selections or conducted their interviews, they would send the application materials of the applicants they were considering to male faculty at Harvard and ask for their sort of stamp of approval. So that fascinated me because there was still this idea that even though this is a kind of women's institute designed to elevate or demonstrate that, you know, women can be as brilliant and accomplished as men, there was still initially this need for a male authority or expert to sign off on the decision making. I saw there was a poetry scholar at Harvard, a literature scholar, Walter Jackson Bate, who approved of Anne Sexton's application. So we have him to thank for her attendance at the Institute.
Well, she was going to be what I wanted to ask you about next. I really didn't know a whole lot about her background and her trajectory career-wise that we see in the book is just fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about her story and how the Institute really changed her path?
I think that's a really great question because I wrestled with the role of the Institute in her life. In part because I think she had a certain kind of natural or innate, I mean, I kind of hate using those words because like, what does it mean to have natural talents or what does it mean to innately be a certain way? But there was a certain kind of untrained talent, a kind of surprising talent that she surprised herself with having. So she learned to write poetry from watching educational programming on Boston's local PBS affiliate. And she sort of just tried her hand at writing some poems. She found this to be therapeutic as she was grappling with postpartum depression and some other mood disorders to have a task to kind of concentrate on and learn. And really within 2 years or so, she was publishing poems in some of the best magazines in the nation. She took a class at the Boston Adult Education Center, which is where she met her the woman who would be her best friend, the poet Maxine Cumin. And Cumin had trained at Harvard, had done both a BA and an MA there. And so she and Sexton kind of worked together, sort of Sexton giving Cumin some of her sort of more interesting images and Cumin kind of teaching her a little bit about literary history and form. But very, very quickly, Sexton's career took off. So by the time she got into the Institute, she had already published one book of poetry, To Bedlam and Partway Back, that had been really well reviewed, and she was working on her second. So the poem she published while at the Institute, it's hard to say whether they would have been published, you know, had she never been there. It seems like she was such a talent that she was going to succeed, and she was so driven. That's the other thing that I didn't know about her, reading her letters and journals. You see that right away she wanted to be a great poet and she was going to make that happen no matter what she had to do. Even if it bothered her husband or her children or her in-laws, she was going to find the time. She was going to commandeer the dining room table and she was going to write the poetry.
That's
so
really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Institute meant a lot to her, even if it wasn't the thing as it was for some of the fellows who attended, where they really felt like they would never have gotten their work done if they hadn't had these advantages and this opportunity. I think she would have, but I think it had a kind of psychological effect for her that was also really important in that it provided her with this kind of legitimacy and also with this kind of community that I think she really took a lot of inspiration from.
Is there anything else that really surprised you in doing this research? I know there were many things that just really blew me away as I was reading. I'm just curious. It must have been very just all consuming to be diving into all this research.
It was. I mean, it was really, I think one of the things that surprised me, to kind of go back to what we were talking about before, was the reach or the sort of widespread excitement over a project like this. So when I was doing research for this, I was looking in the archives in the Schlesinger Library and looking at all of these letters from women across the country who were all from really different backgrounds and really different circumstances, writing and saying, you know, I work at a general store that my husband and I own on Long Island. I have four kids. I've never been to college and I really, really want to go. Can I apply to the Institute and will that let me take college classes? Or, you know, women who had graduated with advanced degrees from universities. There is a letter from a woman that said, you know, I used to study this really specific class of spiders. I have this research on spiders and I haven't been able to finish it. Can I apply to the Institute? Because I think, you know, my spider research is really important and I have a son who's 10 and I can't do both. And I think I didn't realize how across demographics, this need and kind of craving for space to think and to just kind of be a mind or a researcher or an artist apart from all other commitments or demands on your time really seem to permeate so much of American society. And I guess in a way, now that I'm sort of talking this out, maybe what is surprising in part is in looking at some of the strain that women were feeling, you were sort of saying this a moment ago, it's sort of surprising how little that has lessened over the course of the last 60 years, that, you know, we are still reading these books about leaning in or about, you know, having it all or about how you can never have it all or how you can't get everything done. And it just seems that even though I would be remiss if I sort of implied that nothing has changed. You know, we do so many policy changes, legal changes, cultural changes have happened. And yet these fundamental conflicts between a woman's role as a kind of domestic presence and a woman's creative and intellectual life seem to still be around. And we don't really seem to have a much better way of resolving these tensions. That surprised me a little bit.
Yeah, I totally agree. There were so many instances where I kept thinking, wow, so much has changed. I can't, you know, believe that I'm reading this. And then at the other end of the spectrum, oh, so much has not changed. Just so compelling. And the community of women and their friendships, and reading their correspondence was just really interesting as well. So I highly, highly recommend it. If people have, you know, are looking for some.
I think for the women in this book, they took so much solace from realizing, oh, I'm not alone. Mm-hmm. I'm not the only person struggling to make these things work. And sometimes for me, finding that in people who lived before my time is a similar feeling of oh, I'm not alone. This is not me being kind of incompetent and not able to figure this out. This is something that a lot of people struggle with.
Completely. And the other thing I would say along those lines, just that applies to this moment, I was inspired reading all of the letters between them and the correspondence, the ways they found community even from a distance. So that was also sort of perfect for the current time. Well, I always love to just hear what authors are reading. So if you have any books you'd like to recommend to listeners, we would love to hear.
Sure. So I have been doing my fair share of escapist reading, but I have also been taking a little bit of time to read some books or to reread some books that I always find kind of absorbing. So I finally read Phyllis Rose's Parallel Lives about five Victorian marriages, which has been recommended to me so many times. It's always been on my list of things to read. I finally read it. It is wonderful and so so gossipy and morally serious at the same time, which is a really rare combination. My partner and I are reading Charlotte Bronte's Villette aloud to each other at night, which is really just, I mean, Jane Eyre is a great book. I am a Villette. I'm on team Villette in terms of Bronte's output. It's incredibly weird. It's kind of gothic and anti-Catholic and really, you know, it's about living in a convent or not a convent, a convent turned into a school as a young woman and feeling really lonely, but also, you know, feeling really self-righteous. It's a completely weird book, but it's really great.
I haven't read it since college, but I don't really remember it, but I remember liking it.
I hadn't read it. Yeah, exactly. Like I hadn't read it in a long time and I was reading it. I was just like, this book is so weird. It's so great. And I also read the recent Nobel Prize winner, The Drive Your Bones Over the Plow of the Dead, which is also an incredibly strange book, and very short. So it's less intimidating maybe to pick up than some other highly, highly touted or highly accomplished books right now, but it's really great.
Great. Well, I will link to all of those in the show notes. And if people want to connect with you or follow you online, do you have somewhere that you would want to send them?
Sure. Yeah. I am on Twitter, although I'm locked out of my account right now, hoping to rectify that situation through customer support. But I am, my email address and my Twitter name are the same. So mmagsrdoherty, mmagsrdoherty on Twitter and at Gmail. And I have a website through Harvard, which is a scholar.harvard.edu website. And that lists my, the courses I've taught as well as like some of my other writing. So, I'm always happy to correspond. So please feel free to reach out.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on and, best of luck with the book. I really hope people, I normally say pick it up. I really hope people order it online. Wonderful. Well, thank you again and stay safe.
Thank you for having me. You too.
For links to all of the books mentioned on this week's episode, you can visit abookishhome.com. And there you'll also find a link to our new online bookshop. A Bookish Home has teamed up with the new organization bookshop.org, which supports independent bookstores. And if you'd like, you can browse books by authors who have been guests on A Bookish Home. I'm also sharing there all the books mentioned on the podcast, books I've been reading lately, and other recommendations. It's a really wonderful site to browse and look through books. And if you make a purchase, it supports A Bookish Home and independent bookstores. So it's a win-win. So if you want to check that out directly, it's bookshop.org/shop/abookishhome. And you'll also find that at abookishhome.com. If you are enjoying the show, I hope you take a minute to subscribe and also rate and review in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this episode, I would encourage you to share it on social media to help other people find the show and this episode. Thanks for listening, everyone, and happy reading.